It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
Money Movers provides investors with real-time analysis of the stories and the people attracting the attention of markets each day. I'm Carl Quintanilla.
And I'm Sarah Eisen. We'll cover the breaking news and numbers driving stocks and sectors, helping you make critical decisions. Plus, we'll speak with the CEOs, newsmakers, and political leaders playing a role in how your money is moving.
Listen to CNBC's Money Movers free on the Odyssey app.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back, folks. We're joined by Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. He joins us every Monday in the 12 o'clock hour. Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Great to be with you.
So, Guy, Chairman Powell makes comments at the Jackson Hole meeting. Give us a summation of what he had to say.
Okay, so Jackson Hole meeting is a Federal Reserve meeting that is held annually, and it has become a big chance for the chairman to speak about what's going on. And what he said this time was he felt that the time had come for rate cuts. He was very specific. He said the time has come, the direction is clear. So the upside of inflation risk has diminished and the downside risk of unemployment increasing has increased. Therefore, at the next meeting, you know, we will have some rate adjustment. Now, he didn't say 25 basis points or 50. They always remain data dependent, but very emphatic that the direction is clear, the time has come, and his plan is to make a reduction in rates at the September meeting.
So what does that actually mean? And you know, for just the listening audience, I mean, this is all very complex, and we know that about their two missions, right? Fighting inflation and making sure that we have a healthy employment picture, correct?
Yeah. The Federal Reserve is always wrestling with their dual mandate, minimum unemployment and stable to low inflation. Their target is 2%, and the fear is always that they're going to overshoot. Milton Friedman once used an example. You've checked into a motel. You're not really familiar with the shower. You turn it on hot, and you stand there, and you're freezing cold, and then you're blasted. Then you turn it down. Now you're freezing cold again. And you're trying to get that perfect mix. Well, that's what the Fed's trying to do, is get that perfect mix. And there's an interesting term, and it introduced the viewers to it. It's called R-starred. You can dazzle people with that economic term. R-starred is the neutral rate of Fed funds. It used to be that people thought it was 2.5%. Now the thought is it's 3%. One of the fun things about it is economists say, we can't tell you what the R-starred neutral rate is, but we'll know when we get there. So more lack of clarity from economists, but the thought is that the Fed funds rate will gradually trend down to around 3%. That would mean the prime rate would go down to about 5%. The question is how much mortgage rates will go down, somewhat, but not as much as the short-term rates. So it's going to be a bit of a mix. If you're a commercial borrower with rates indexed to the prime rate, your rate will go down. If you're a consumer, your lending rates typically don't go down. One analogy is people say they go up like a rocket, they come down like a feather. and that's probably pretty accurate. Now, what will happen, and this is that there's always a little negative with a positive, if you're a saver and you're living on fixed income, interest rates that you're going to get paid for short-term deposits will decline. And yeah. We talked to people for months about extending the maturities and getting longer-term rates, and very few people listen to that advice, but now they're beginning to think, gee, I should have bought longer-term investment securities a few months ago when we were talking about it instead of waiting until now rates are falling.
So, Guy, when we look at the dual mandate, right, managing inflation and keeping unemployment low, for the Fed, well, let me ask this question first. For the economy, which one's worse, inflation or high unemployment?
Wow. If I had to pick one, I would say inflation is worse because it hits everybody. Unemployment is worse if you're the guy who or a lady who lost their job. Right. So inflation, though, is very, very dangerous to society as a whole because it depletes value, it reduces net worth, and it affects every single person. So, and it particularly hurts the poor. One of the challenges is that if you're literally spending everything you make, which an awful lot of Americans are, and look, I've been there. I know what it's like. The month end arrives and the money is not quite enough to get there. Everything you get, you spend. Well, if prices go up, you start having to make tough choices. You know, what am I going to do? And first, they're easy. Okay, I'm not going to go out to the movie. And I remember when we were a young married couple, if it wasn't showing at the dollar movie theater, we weren't going to see it. Most of today's folks don't even know what the dollar movie theaters were. But once upon a time, you had movie theaters in New Orleans that showed second-run movies for a dollar. And we weren't buying popcorn. Well, when you run out of easy choices, then you have to start making food choices. You have to, and then in the horrible case, you hear people making decisions, what prescription drug do I buy? You know, do I pay the utility or the rent? And that's an awful place to be. So I guess inflation is worse than unemployment.
So when it comes to in this dual purpose that the Fed has, which one is harder to manage just by the adjustment of these rates, inflation or unemployment?
The Fed probably has more control over inflation because you can bring the economy to a halt with high enough interest rates. And Paul Volcker did that when inflation was out of control. And, I mean, there was a time when the prime rate was up in the 20s and, you know, mortgage rates were in the high teens. And, you know, he brought things to a screeching halt in order to eliminate inflation. And interesting Federal Reserve trivia, the institution that gets no credit at all is the Kansas City Fed. The Kansas City Fed hosts the Jackson Hole meeting, and no one ever mentions that. It's always Jackson Hole. The reason it's Jackson Hole is they were hosting an economic conference and nobody was coming, and somebody told them that Paul Volcker liked to fly fish. So they found a resort closest to the best fly fishing in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and set up their conference. And sure enough, Paul Volcker came. And from then on, that Jackson Hole meeting became the key meeting for the Federal Reserve.
That's a pretty nice place to meet, that's for sure.
Oh, it absolutely is. Temperature, weather conditions. But, I mean, the Atlanta Fed has a meeting, and nobody talks about that, and San Francisco's tried one, and the other Feds, they're all a bit jealous of the Kansas Fed, although they deliberately don't give the Kansas Fed any credit for hosting, because most people don't even realize it's their meeting.
So if it's easier for them to manage inflation by rate adjustment, then, I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much of this really is a guessing game for them, relative to unemployment?
Oh, it's always a guessing game. And one of the challenges, the Fed has limited tools. You know, the Fed really can only affect the money supply and the interest rates. So those tools are very good for dealing with inflation. They're not so good for dealing with employment. you know, one of the challenges is you really would like to deal with some fiscal policies, some regulatory policies, some things that make it hard to hire folks. And the Fed has no control over any of those things. So it's, if unemployment gets out of control, it's going to be very hard for the Fed to deal with that. I mean, they will lower rates. They'll try and stimulate the economy. And there's a lot, and what they call an uncertain lag. So it's a tough dual mandate. And their idea is let's try and get to neutral so we don't have to make too many adjustments. Sort of like somebody driving a boat and they oversteer one direction, oversteer another, and you look behind, it looks like a snake is in the wake of the boat. And that's what they want to avoid.
Because, Guy, one of the things you and I have talked about is that in these job reports, the number one hiring sector is government, almost every month. So I went this past weekend and I was looking at the data, but we're not really increasing the number of government employees. We're replacing the number of government employees that fell out as a result of the pandemic. So I'm curious whether, you know, we're looking at pandemic adjusted numbers to figure out where we actually are. Because in comparison to 2019, the data I was looking at was completely wrong, there were more government employees back then than there are now. And we're just simply catching up and still coming back, and it's kind of amazing and maybe even disappointing that government's coming back slower than everybody else.
Well, and part of that challenge is some of the government jobs have not adjusted for inflation. You know, it's a government problem. And one area that affects everybody in America is law enforcement. There's not a police department in the country that I can think of that has been able to get back to the staffing levels that they want, whether it's NOPD, whether it's New York City. You know, it's really tough. And a lot of that is a challenge of not paying enough and then other different issues. So some of the essential workers you want, they have not been able to recruit. The other thing is government has a challenge getting skilled people in things like IT. And one of the things government does then is outsource. And sometimes outsourcing is more efficient. Sometimes it's not. I mean, we see that in the city of New Orleans. It's a city that used to have a big Department of Public Works that would repair streets. Now we outsource it all with the idea that it's going to be more efficient. Well, sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. So some of the problem for municipalities is getting the right skilled people in the right jobs. And some of it is just the slowness of governments to get to do virtually anything. It's very hard for government to move fast.
So when we think about, you know, this corrective landscape that we're still in, you would agree we're still in this corrective landscape from the pandemic relative to jobs?
We are, and we're probably about at the end of it. We had the big travel surge, and that travel surge is now over. You know, for a while, airlines just couldn't get enough planes, couldn't hire enough pilots. Now we're at the opposite end. The only airline group that has any sort of a class for new pilots is Frontier. All the mainline carriers are not scheduling new classes, and Spirit has laid off pilots. So that travel surge is over, so that's been adjusted. The supply chains are pretty much in good order. So those pandemic things are fixed. The numbers haven't been fixed. There was a giant adjustment to jobs, a big negative adjustment of about 800,000. And the government said, oops, we thought there were more people working than there really are. So we're seeing a little bit of confusion in the statistics. You and I have talked about the fragile labor market, and that continues. And I think that's something that Chairman Powell was saying, but he didn't want to go into too deeply when he said the risk of unemployment going up is now greater than the risk of inflation going up.
But that's, I guess, kind of interesting. I mean, look, right now, I mean, there's a lot of confusion out there because there's so many different spins because of the election season, right? And I'm sure folks are going to say, well, this rate adjustment's a positive thing. In my view, it really isn't. I mean, it is a remedy to something that's not good, unemployment, right? Inflation is, they're saying, is better, but better is still not good, right?
Yeah, it's one of the challenging things for inflation is none of the big forecasting groups that do forward projections see inflation getting down to 2%. They all have it getting, you know, 2.5, 2.75, some, you know, 2.25, but none of them quite get to 2. So if that's the target, most economists don't think we're going to get there. So that presents a challenge. The labor market, you know, instability is a challenge. And right now, fortunately, we're fairly close to the election. Business doesn't like uncertainty. They want to know what's what. So until we know the makeup of the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives, it's hard to know what the situation is going to be in terms of taxes, regulation, you know, international relations. So that also is something that's pushing unemployment because people are really a bit afraid to go forward.
Well, when you hear a lot about back and forth, you know, the vice president saying we're going to rebuild the middle class, higher wages, higher this, higher that. We are going to impose a 28% corporate tax rate. None of that really bodes well for increasing employment, right?
Well, one of the things that we all have to wait on, there are a lot of things that are mentioned in campaigns that never come true. And until you know the makeup of the House and Senate, you don't know. Now, the one thing we do know is Europe has a relatively low corporate tax rate for the same reason we do. Corporate taxes are simply a way of collecting money from consumers. You know, the government, the business serves as the tax collector. But there's not a magic pool of money at McDonald's or Shell that they can pay taxes from. So when you raise corporate taxes, you're going to reduce either payrolls or increase cost to consumers or reduce net worth of shareholders. The reason Europe has kept their rates low is they realize that that's not an attractive thing to do. And if we get way out of sync with Europe and the rest of the world, we'll get back into that horrible world of corporate inversions where companies find it's more profitable to be headquartered overseas. And we haven't heard any of that discussion for a long time. And it's because our rates are effectively the same of Europe's. And that's one area where we really need to be in sync with the rest of the developed world. You know, if they're 22, we need to be 22. If they're 23, we can afford to be 23. Some countries like Ireland have always thought that being a little lower gave them a competitive advantage. And the growth in Ireland would tend to indicate that may be right.
It's because we're at 21 right now. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, which is, I think, a good rate. It keeps us in sync with Europe. And, you know, the European have a number of different rates, but they average about 22. So we're right in sync with them. We don't want to be a lot higher than they are.
Got a text message here. What is the history on the dual mandate? Was that always the case, or when was employment added?
No, it wasn't always the case, and I wish I could give you the date it was added, but unemployment was added to the Fed's mandate. In the Paul Volcker era, it was just inflation, and so it was relatively easy to deal with that. And sometimes people thought about expanding the mandate of the Federal Reserve and giving them, you know, environmental issues or other different issues. And I always advise against that they have limited tools and you really don't want to push them into things that they're not good at.
Yeah.
And the dual mandate, Newell, I just checked, was 1977.
1977. Interesting.
Yep.
That was the Carter years, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting. All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. When we come back, we'll talk about new rules for real estate commissions, a Taylor Swift Facebook ticket fraud, the collapse of fintech Synapse leaves millions of investor dollars stranded. We'll be right back, folks.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is the secret story of a young Russian oligarch who hacked his way to a $93 million fortune. I'm CNBC senior Washington correspondent Eamon Javers. In our new podcast, The Crimes of Putin's Traitor, I'll take you inside a shocking Russian crime targeting the American financial system. Attacks that sources tell me were welcomed by Vladimir Putin's government. Listen to CNBC's The Crimes of Putin's Traitor free on the Odyssey app.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
Welcome back, folks. We are visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. So, Guy, real estate commissions, I guess this deals primarily with residential real estate at the present time. These new rules going into effect, and what do they provide?
Okay. What happened is in the National Association of Realtors lost a class action suit. And prior to the new rules going into effect, you'd have a commission that would be split between the buyer's agent and the seller's agent. And whatever that fee was, and consumers have always been able to negotiate when they list a house what they're going to pay. Some people say 6% on the first 100,000, 3% thereafter. Some will say 5% on the whole thing. You can even negotiate a flat amount, a fixed dollar amount. But in the old days, that was split evenly between the buyer and the seller. Now, the realtors, because of this new settlement and because of losing the lawsuit, the MLS cannot talk about the commission that is paid to the buyer's agent. And one of the things that's happened is they're changing the language. It's compensation instead of commission. So if you want to be represented by an agent, you have to negotiate. You as a buyer would negotiate a separate fee and say, I'll pay X percent or X dollars to my agent to help me find a house. And when you're listing a house, you negotiate with the listing agent, okay, I'm going to pay this amount to the listing agent. Now, it's created a lot of confusion. It just went into effect last week. Sometimes if you show up at an open house, the listing agent will say, well, do you have an agent representing you? If the answer is no, sometimes they won't show you the house unless you sign an agreement saying that if you buy the house, you know, they'll get a commission. Sometimes they'll let you look at the house, but when you make an offer, you have to specifically say, who's going to get what? So it's raised a little bit of confusion, and it's something that, you know, real estate agents are going to have to deal with, and buyers are certainly going to have to deal with, because it's a new world out there, and it's not as clear as it used to be.
So what do you think, if we're talking about this issue 2-3 years from today, looking in your crystal ball as to the way this kind of works out operationally, what do you think it's going to look like?
I think what's going to happen is people will realize that a skilled realtor is valuable, and it is worth paying for professional advice. It's sort of like thinking, you know, you don't really need a skilled lawyer or a skilled doctor. You know, we recently settled my mom's estate and sold her house, and you know, just there were a lot of little details that we had to work through. And our agent was very, very helpful in working through those details. I mean, we had you know, different zoning issues. There was a little extra property that was acquired at a separate time. And having someone that really knew what they were doing really helped make that process work well. I'm not sure that we would have been able to get to the sale without a skilled realtor. So I think the good realtors, the ones that are that add value, are going to be just fine. I think there will be a settling down of commissions, and people will look, and once again, they don't want to call it commissions now, compensation. It may trend down a little bit because it will be more explicit. But I think that for the good realtors, they're going to be just fine because people will recognize, look, I need professional help. And some of the buyers will go in and will not have anyone representing them. So whoever the listing agent will get the complete compensation from the seller. So it's going to be a settling process. Our fees tend to be a little bit higher than the rest of the developed world. So there may be a trend down a bit. And it's going to depend on the market as well. New Orleans is a unique market, the New Orleans metro area. We've just crossed that sort of magic threshold of 6 months supply. So it's now transitioning to be a buyer's market instead of a seller's market with, you know, more leverage on the buy side.
Is it this, in the end, I mean, is this really about access to the MLS, which is that multi-listing service? I mean, you know, so
the reason the realtors lost the lawsuit is they maintained exclusive access to MLS, didn't let anyone else in. And when the judges looked at it, they said this really is a restraint of trade. It looks like you're unfairly pushing commissions higher because only agents that agree to have the buyer and seller compensated with one agreement can access MLS. So, you know, the courts decided that that was unfair, and that was really the basis of this this lawsuit. Now, I'm not going to opine on whether that was a good or bad legal decision, but that was why they made that decision. And so now, in order to have a realtor show you a house, you will have, when you call a realtor, you'll have to sign an agreement defining, you know, who's paying, and if the realtor is representing you as a buyer, you'll have to negotiate, look, I'm going to pay this amount. The other thing is the MLS is not...
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, the MLS book cannot say we'll split commissions with the buyer's agent. So that was one of the prohibited things in the agreement as a result of the lawsuit. So you can't talk about what might be done and what negotiation might occur. So it has to just specifically talk about the selling agent.
So really nothing has changed as it relates to access to the MLS, then. It's the same. You're
not
basically
really.
You're paying somebody. The question is whether or not they're going to succumb to your demand. And I guess it puts a lot of pressure on the seller then in many respects because, you know, a lot of people ask a price that they know they can't get, right? And they're willing, they're not in a hurry, they're willing to let it sit out there. And the seller that prices it right kind of is at a little bit of a disadvantage from a negotiating standpoint because if you have a healthy balance of both, it doesn't really change negotiating leverage or power.
Well, I think when you're in a balanced market, houses are going to have a certain reasonable value that they'll sell for. The
Sure.
advantage that you get as a seller is if you get an agent who understands the market, they'll be able to tell you, say, look, you're in the range of 350, 375. Let's list it at 380 just in case there's somebody who's been watching this house and really, really wants it. But if after a month or so, no one has made an offer in that range, then we'll get into the real range that we expect and reduce a little bit. That advice is real valuable if you're a seller because most sellers don't really have a clue what their house is worth. So getting a good realtor to help you with that is, I think, real helpful. And same thing if you're a buyer. You know, having a realtor say, look, these houses are overpriced. This is reasonable. This is what you should expect to pay for a three-bedroom house in a nice neighborhood or one of the neighborhoods you've identified. But the biggest difference is you're going to have to specifically agree with either your listing agent or your agent representing you how much compensation they're going to receive. So that's going to be a very, very specific item.
Now, this lawsuit, does it distinguish between residential property and commercial property?
It's only refers to residential. So
Are they different in the commercial world?
I think the thought is that the commercial buyers are more sophisticated, and there are always different rules for consumers versus businesses.
Hey, do you think, same question 3 years from today, do you see this residential phenomenon creeping into the commercial world?
Well, you already have a difference. So if you're selling a property that, you know, is a very expensive commercial property, a hotel that might be worth $10 or $20 million, the seller is not going to pay, you know, a large commission to the selling agent. That'll be a negotiated amount that'll be lower than the standard.
The vast majority of commercial property is really not too terribly different than the top 15% of residential property price-wise, right?
Well, it depends. I mean, once you get beyond one to four family houses, which is what this covers, and you get into like a whole apartment complex with 300 units, then it is different.
Yeah.
I mean, you're in a different world.
Yeah, those are different. But if I'm talking about a 5,000 square foot warehouse or a 7,000 square foot rack, you know, I mean, they're similarly in the price range of what you find, you know, medium to high price homes. I mean, and that's the vast majority of commercial property in this country, right? I mean, from a number standpoint, not valuation, but just numbers.
Yeah, and it depends on the area. I mean, we're in an area where we have smaller businesses. If you get into areas where you have giant data centers, big warehouses, you know, imagine Dallas, Texas, commercial properties,
yeah,
you know, tend
Manhattan
to be much bigger. Yeah, the old joke, everything's bigger in Texas. Well, the commercial properties
right.
are bigger in Texas.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see where this, you hear a lot about this, you know, and all of a sudden this complete disruption in the whole way that that market has worked. It's kind of interesting to see where it will end up. All right, we got to get to another break. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Yet another Taylor Swift Facebook ticket situation, ticket fraud. Tell us about it, Guy.
Scary. And it comes to every city that has Taylor Swift concerts, so get ready, New Orleans. Susan Ballmer in Algonquin, Illinois, minding her business. She and her family are having a Sunday dinner. Erica Frond knocks on the door, opens the door, and Susan says, well, you know, what are you doing here? So where are my tickets? I said, what do you mean, where are my tickets? Where are my Taylor Swift tickets? A bitter conversation was avoided when they sat down and understood that Susan had never listed Taylor Swift tickets. But what had happened is her Facebook account had been cloned. So evil schemers had gone online, created a duplicate Facebook account, and sent out a notice to all of Susan's friends saying, I've got Taylor Swift tickets. Unfortunately, I can't use them. I'm not trying to take advantage. I'm just going to sell them for face value. DM me and we'll arrange payment. Well, what the people didn't realize is it was a cloned fake Facebook account. Susan didn't have any Taylor Swift tickets. Literally dozens of her friends DM'd. The scammer then said, Venmo me the money. And as soon as they got the money, said, okay, now there's a transfer fee, and that just kept upping the ante. But finally, people said, okay, I paid the money, I need to get the tickets. The scammer said, all right, we'll meet at a public place. In this case, they chose IHOP, didn't show up. And some of the people that bought tickets or thought they bought tickets went online and Googled her address. And if you think about Facebook, that's not that hard to do. You know, a lot of folks on Facebook post pictures of their house. They post pictures of their kids, of the school, of events. And so Erica was upset, and she said, I'm just going to go confront her at her house and demand my tickets. And that's how the Sunday afternoon excursion occurred and could have gone really ugly. Unfortunately, dozens of Susan's friends sent money. So they're out about $1,000 each. They're mad at her. She didn't do anything. Facebook was almost no help. And because of the controversy, when Susan tried to reopen a separate Facebook account to start over, they blocked her from creating a new account because of the cloned account. So it really was a horrible situation, and it has been occurring. It occurred in Middleton, Virginia. Maggie Blanchard, same thing, got scammed, and literally dozens of her friends sent thousands of dollars to the scammers. So now her friends are mad at her. She didn't do it, and she's really, really upset. And once again, you can't get someone on the phone at Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg is not going to take your phone call to resolve this problem. Yeah, so this is something people need to be aware of.
Got a text here. An evil schemer took over my sister-in-law's Facebook account and used it to sell fake Taylor Swift tickets. True dat. So it's happening already here. People are talking about it.
Yeah, because we're in the market, and I think it's time to talk about. There are only a few things you can do to protect yourself. Cloning the accounts is something that can be done to anybody. They'll pick up your picture, they'll do that. But there is one thing you can do, and we strongly, strongly advise people to do it. Go on your Facebook profile, click on your profile picture, and then when it talks about who can see your privacy settings, who can see your list of friends, set that to only the owner of the account. Because what happens with these cloned accounts is they will then send the request to all of your friends. So now you're literally alienating all your friends, and you didn't even realize it was happening. So if you set up a privacy setting so only you can see your friend list, the scammers don't have access. The other thing is some people just take over the account by getting the login ID. And we've talked about dual factor, and I feel like I'm sometimes shouting at the ocean, but go to dual factor on Facebook so that no one else can log in unless they do the dual factor, which means you'll get a text message on your cell phone verifying that it's you. But if you don't do this, you could really be in trouble. And it's unfortunate because you can lose access to your account. Your friends are going to be really upset, and it's a very frustrating situation to be in. And because of the Taylor Swift concert coming to New Orleans, we can expect this sort of activity to occur right here.
Yeah, this is a shame for sure. Let's talk about one last topic. The collapse of the FinTech Synapse leaves millions of investor dollars stranded. This is an interesting story.
Yeah, it really is. You know, we have a lot of these fintechs that start up. FX Security was one. Synapse is another one. And what happens is people look at these online things and they believe that they're real. And they think, okay, this is secure. And what happens is they will send money there. They will start trading at this account, using it typically to buy Bitcoin and other things. But what happens is if there's any sort of financial trouble, you're not FDIC insured. Now, they may say, you know, your deposits are being deposited at a bank with FDIC insurance, which is true, but not true. It's true that they may have a bank account. Of course, everybody has a bank account, but it's only $250,000. It's not for every single customer. So they sort of waltz around FDIC insurance and make people think that they have insurance that they don't have. And the tragedy is, particularly in the Synapse, it was hundreds of millions of dollars. People were in that. They were using it to deposit their savings. And you had just some heartbreaking stories. A guy that had a job he hated was saving up. He was ready to start his business. And literally a week away from taking the money out to start his business, it's frozen. He doesn't know when he's going to get it back. So now he's stuck working in a job he hates, can't start the business. He has some sunk expenses. People that had planned to retire can't get their retirement out. And so when you're dealing with one of these non-regulated, non-FDIC insured institutions, if it goes bad, you can wait a long time to get your money back. And the SEC will say, we're looking into it, we're concerned, but they don't have a pool of money to write a check. So your money can be frozen for quite a while. And you may not get all of it back. And that's the real scary part.
Yeah, you know, you read these stories and people think they're doing the right thing, and they are in a lot of cases, and then they get caught up into this quagmire and they can't figure out what to do. And meanwhile, they're just completely off the rails, going broke.
Yeah, and, you know, you can't believe people do what they do, but there's a man named Seja Patel who was the VP of compliance at Synapse, and he told FinTech Business Weekly, the reality was Synapse screening process was homegrown and the code didn't work. Multiple BSA audits revealed the model was broken. But they still took in customer deposits. And so when it happened, the folks that were involved knew that they created a problem and they were really stuck. And they were, you know, a lot of different things happened. They were a victim of a cyber attack by Russian ransomware groups. So they lost a lot of data, a lot of customer data was sent out. And now customers are just waiting and wondering what they're actually going to get back. And it's just a good reminder that you really don't want to send your money to an institution that is not either regulated by the regular securities regulations like most brokerages are, or by FDIC, because you are at risk if it goes bad.
Absolutely. As always, Guy Williams, we really appreciate your time and your insight. Really enjoyed speaking with you today. Have a great week.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you, and you too.
We will be right back. Check in with Scoot when we return. Stay with us. Ian Hoax in for Scoot. What do we have coming up, Ian?
Hey, good afternoon, Sheriff. Sesame Street character Elmo, he asked on Twitter back in January how everybody was doing. And the answers that Elmo got were really dark and depressing. And Sesame Street was totally taken off guard by this. And they said, God, we got to do something. So they commissioned this survey. And now they put out a report called The State of Well-Being in America. We're going to talk to a social media and mental health expert, Dave Batt, about why we're so upset. Do we all have undiagnosed mental health issues to a certain extent? In the first hour, we're going to be visiting with LSU professor of political science, Robert Hogan, about RFK dropping out and endorsing Donald Trump. I'm also going to ask, have you seen people acting badly in restaurants? What are the worst restaurant behaviors? We got the top 10. We want to see if yours make the list.
Stay tuned. Ian's coming your way. Hope you enjoyed today's show. See you in the morning. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Yet another Taylor Swift Facebook ticket situation, ticket fraud. Tell us about it, Guy.
Scary. And it comes to every city that has Taylor Swift concerts, so get ready, New Orleans. Susan Ballmer in Algonquin, Illinois, minding her business. She and her family are having a Sunday dinner. Erica Frowned, knocks on the door, opens the door, and Susan says, well, you know, what are you doing here? So where are my tickets? I said, what do you mean, where are my Taylor Swift tickets? A bitter conversation was avoided when they sat down and understood that Susan had never listed Taylor Swift tickets. But what had happened is her Facebook account had been cloned. So evil schemers had gone online, created a duplicate Facebook account, and sent out a notice to all of Susan's friends saying, I've got Taylor Swift tickets. Unfortunately, I can't use them. I'm not trying to take advantage. I'm just going to sell them for face value. DM me, and we'll arrange payment. Well, what the people didn't realize is it was a cloned fake Facebook account. Susan didn't have any Taylor Swift tickets. Literally dozens of her friends DM'd. The scammer then said, Venmo me the money. And as soon as they got the money, said, okay, now there's a transfer fee, and that just kept upping the ante. But finally, people said, okay, I've paid the money. I need to get the tickets. The scammer said, all right, we'll meet at a public place. In this case, they chose IHOP. Didn't show up. And some of the people that bought tickets or thought they bought tickets went online and Googled her address. And if you think about Facebook, that's not that hard to do. You know, a lot of folks on Facebook post pictures of their house. They post pictures of their kids, of the school, of events. And so Erica was upset, and she said, I'm just going to go confront her at her house and demand my tickets. And that's how the Sunday afternoon excursion occurred, and could have gone really ugly. Unfortunately, dozens of Susan's friends sent money. So they're out about $1,000 each. They're mad at her. She didn't do anything. Facebook was almost no help. And because of the controversy, when Susan tried to reopen a separate Facebook account to start over, they blocked her from creating a new account because of the cloned account. So it really was a horrible situation, and it has been occurring. It occurred in Middleton, Virginia. Maggie Blanchard, same thing, got scammed, and literally dozens of her friends sent thousands of dollars to the scammers. So now her friends are mad at her. She didn't do it, and she's really, really upset. And once again, you can't get someone on the phone at Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg is not going to take your phone call to resolve this problem. Yeah, so this is something people need to be aware of.
Got a text here. An evil schemer took over my sister-in-law's Facebook account and used it to sell fake Taylor Swift tickets. True dat. So it's happening already here. People are talking about it.
Yeah, because we're in the market, and I think it's time to talk about. There are only a few things you can do to protect yourself. Cloning the accounts is something that can be done to anybody. They'll pick up your picture, they'll do that. But there is one thing you can do, and we strongly, strongly advise people to do it. Go on your Facebook profile, click on your profile picture, and then when it talks about who can see your privacy settings, who can see your list of friends, set that to only the owner of the account. Because what happens with these cloned accounts is they will then send the request to all of your friends. So now you're literally alienating all your friends, and you didn't even realize it was happening. So if you set up a privacy setting so only you can see your friend list, the scammers don't have access. The other thing is some people just take over the account by getting the login ID. And we've talked about dual factor, and I feel like I'm sometimes shouting at the ocean, but go to dual factor on Facebook so that no one else can log in unless they do the dual factor, which means you'll get a text message on your cell phone verifying that it's you. But if you don't do this, you could really be in trouble. And it's unfortunate because you can lose access to your account. Your friends are going to be really upset, and it's a very frustrating situation to be in. And because of the Taylor Swift concert coming to New Orleans, we can expect this sort of activity to occur right here.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a shame for sure. Let's talk about one last topic. The collapse of the Fintech Synapse leaves millions of investor dollars stranded. This is an interesting story.
Yeah, it really is. You know, we have a lot of these fintechs that start up. FX Security was one. Synapse is another one. And what happens is people look at these online things and they believe that they're real. And they think, okay, this is secure. And what happens is they will send money there. They will start trading at this account, using it typically to buy Bitcoin and other things. But what happens is if there's any sort of financial trouble, you're not FDIC insured. Now, they may say, you know, your deposits are being deposited at a bank with FDIC insurance, which is true, but not true. It's true that they may have a bank account. Of course, everybody has a bank account, but it's only $250,000. It's not for every single customer. So they sort of waltz around FDIC insurance and make people think that they have insurance that they don't have. And the tragedy is, particularly in the Synapse, it was hundreds of millions of dollars. People were in that. They were using it to deposit their savings. And you had just some heartbreaking stories. A guy that had a job he hated was saving up. He was ready to start his business. And literally a week away from taking the money out to start his business, it's frozen. He doesn't know when he's going to get it back. So now he's stuck working in a job he hates, can't start the business. He has some sunk expenses. People that had planned to retire can't get their retirement out. And so when you're dealing with one of these non-regulated, non-FDIC insured institutions, if it goes bad, you can wait a long time to get your money back. And the SEC will say, we're looking into it, we're concerned, but they don't have a pool of money to write a check. So your money can be frozen for quite a while. And you may not get all of it back. And that's the real scary part.
Yeah, you read these stories and people think they're doing the right thing, and they are in a lot of cases. And then they get caught up into this quagmire and they can't figure out what to do. And meanwhile, they're just completely off the rails, going broke.
Yeah. And, you know, you can't believe people do what they do. But there's a man named Sijia Patel, who was the VP of compliance at Synapse. And he told FinTech Business Weekly, the reality was Synapse screening process was homegrown and the code didn't work. Multiple BSA audits revealed the model was broken. But they still took in customer deposits. And so when it happened, the folks that were involved knew that they created a problem and they were really stuck. And they were, you know, a lot of different things happened. They were a victim of a cyber attack by Russian ransomware groups. So they lost a lot of data. A lot of customer data was sent out. And now customers are just waiting and wondering what they're actually going to get back. And it's just a good reminder that you really don't want to send your money to an institution that is not either regulated by the regular securities regulations like most brokerages are, or by FDIC, because you are right at risk if it goes bad.
Absolutely. As always, Guy Williams, we really appreciate your time and your insight. Really enjoyed speaking with you today. Have a great week.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you, and you too.
We will be right back. Check in with Scoot when we return. Stay with us. Ian Hoke's in for Scoot. What do we have coming up, Ian?
Hey, good afternoon, Sheriff. Sesame Street character Elmo, he asked on Twitter back in January how everybody was doing. And the answers that Elmo got were really dark and depressing. And Sesame Street was totally taken off guard by this. And they said, God, we got to do something. So they commissioned this survey. And now they put out a report called The State of Well-Being in America. We're going to talk to a social media and mental health expert, Dave Batt, about why we're so upset. Do we all have undiagnosed mental health issues to a certain extent? In the first hour, we're going to be visiting with LSU professor of political science, Robert Hogan, about RFK dropping out and endorsing Donald Trump. I'm also going to ask, have you seen people acting badly in restaurants? What are the worst restaurant behaviors? We got the top 10. We want to see if yours make the list.
Stay tuned. Ian's coming your way. Hope you enjoyed today's show. See you in the morning.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You got to take a listen to this. It's Squawk Pod.
That's right. CNBC's flagship business news show is a podcast, Squawk Pod.
This is CNBC Control 2.
It is not just the show, folks.
It might be even better because it's only audio.
Join me, Katie Kramer, as I take you inside the Squawk Box control room and beyond the headlines of our TV broadcast with Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every weekday.
Roll alpha.
Listen to CNBC's Squawk Pod free on the Odyssey app.
It's better over here.
After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device credit service ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.